This is Bloomberg Intelligence.
The new tools that a metaverse can bring allows you to create more immersive content.
Companies are beginning to sell less oil, more electrons.
In-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
The supply chain breakdown is combining with labor shortages.
Will Eastern manufacturers continue to dominate, or will there be a renewed interest in Western manufacturing?
Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Over the next hour, we're going to dig inside the big business stories impacting Wall Street and the global markets.
Each and every week, we provide in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies and 130 industries our analysts cover worldwide.
Coming up on the show, it is back to the stores. For the holidays, we're going to look at the renaissance of brick and mortar this season.
Plus, asset managers are set to become the new enforcers of carbon change.
But first, we want to talk about emerging markets, particularly what the outlook is going to be in 2022, because it's a couple things going on here. One is that stronger dollar, that's going to put pressure on emerging markets, particularly also rising rates. And then there's some idiosyncratic stories. How much does China slow? How bad can Turkey actually get? Does Argentina have any money? All of these are good and good questions for investors to know. So we turn to Damian Sassauer, Bloomberg Intelligence Chief Emerging Markets Credit Strategist. Damian, there's a lot to discuss. And I wonder, overall, how do you think emerging markets are going to do next year?
Well, structurally, Alex.
He's already in there. I'm not finished my question.
I mean, I'm not even going to let you finish. structurally, I'm still a dollar bull. I don't think that's changed in the better part of the last 10 years. I think it's really, really tough in an environment where U.S. rates are rising, where the taper is poised to accelerate, for anyone to really dip into their pockets and move their money offshore, because that should all be beneficial to the dollar. So I don't think that changes. That's the first sort of headwind that emerging market investors are contending with. But look, I mean, if you indeed believe that the first half of 2022 is going to be about inflation fears, well, then the second half, I think that will give way to growth fears. And once that kind of comeuppance begins, that's when you might want to start looking at emerging markets. And hopefully at that point, the yield will be higher, because we expect to see a lot more rate hikes across the spectrum between now and then.
All right, let's go to China. When you talk to your institutional investor clients, is China investable here?
Absolutely. In fact, it's probably one of those idiosyncratic opportunities that Alex referred to. I mean, let's be clear, China high yield credit, which is predominantly the property sector, which has been getting crushed for the better part of the last, call it 6 months, a reckoning is now kind of occurring here, Paul. I mean, basically what you're seeing is a relaxation of mortgage credit, of standards, of lending to the sector in China. I don't want to say that Beijing has found religion, but certainly the PBOC is relaxing standards, and that is definitely beneficial for the market. In the past few weeks, we've seen a huge, huge rally in many of those dollar bonds issued by the distressed property sector. And so I expect a little bit more of that to continue. It's one area where, you know, there are people making money in emerging markets. That's one sector, if there is any. So, yeah.
But some people are making money, but they also probably lost a lot of money with the really surprising tech crackdown, the crackdown on education, on entertainment, on billionaires.
And more to the point, I mean, there's still a lot to unpeel in the property sector. There are still a lot of troubled companies that still have to make coupon payments to dollar creditors. Mm-hmm. They may technically default in the next few months. In fact, our base case for a few of them are, in fact, that you do need to see a restructuring. I'm talking Evergrande here, despite the fact that Chairman Huihui Kan has basically sold two of his $100 million peak mansions and a couple Gulf Streams and a couple football teams. No, I'm just kidding. But look, I mean, the reality is, you know, look, I think everyone's got the message here. You know, I think it's safe to say that President Xi is not really putting the onus on growth the way he has in past years. And I think that change is kind of, I think common prosperity is just more important to him. So it's this sort of Mao Zedong versus Deng Xiaoping kind of dynamic that's going on here. And I think common prosperity is going to win out in the end.
All right, Tom Keene did email in. He wants me to ask about Turkish lira. What do I need to know here?
So look, I mean, we have had a really, really rough time in the Turkish lira. It is a very small portion of the emerging market universe, at least from a local currency standpoint. It's a much bigger portion of EM dollar credit, but just sticking on the local, and that's where the lira decline is really going to hit hardest. Yeah, it's been really painful. I mean, we've seen one, two, three, four big figure moves in the better part of the last week alone. I think the currency has lost nearly a third of its value, really just in November alone. So it's really been painful for any investor. Not many are invested there, but any investor who happens to be there. But look, I mean, you know, for me, the geostrategic importance of Turkey, you know, just its location in the Bosphorus, the fact that it's just, you know, its military is still quite large, and the fact that it's still 85 million people and they're dealing with this migrant crisis from Syria. There's just a lot to unpeel there. It's not going away anytime soon. It's not really comparable to an Argentina or, you know, some others there. But nevertheless, that's exactly where it's headed if it lets the lira run this way. I mean, there's no credibility in the central bank. They have no FX reserves left to defend the lira, and that's why you're seeing these big moves.
All right, let's just turn quickly to our friends in Latin America, South America. Where do I need to be thinking about for 2022?
Right. Well, I think right now the real kind of focus is on the elections in Argentina and Chile. We just got out of midterms in Argentina. It's waiting for any progress with the IMF. You know, there's a lot of debt due to the IMF. I mean, I can't remember the number offhand. Oh, no, I can. It's $325 billion of debt, of which $40 billion is due to the IMF. They need to get that sorted. I mean, a lot of those maturities are coming due in just the next year alone. And so that's where eyes are focused. Hopefully, this recent election is an eye-opener. The other big one is Chile. And Chile, basically, right now, we have just emerged from their presidential election. It went to a runoff. December 19th is when you're going to see Jose Antonio Kast, who's the big right wing, versus Gabriel Boric, who is the left wing. The markets are hoping more of a right wing candidate wins. So they're looking for Kast to win that. I think that would probably be better for evaluations. But it's very, very possible that Boric wins. And then we could see, you know, all bets off, more populist policies out of Chile. And that would not necessarily be good for the Chilean peso and for asset valuations on the ground. So that's where Latin America is for me right now.
Okay, so on that note, bye-bye. Damian Sassauer, Bloomberg Intelligence, Chief Emerging Market Credit Strategist, the best in the business.
Coming up on the program, we turn to FX and discuss the drivers behind euro-dollar weakness.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 13 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, let's talk currencies here. Let's talk euro-dollar. The euro's really been weak relative to the dollar. The question is, how do you play it going forward? Let's bring in Bloomberg Intelligence Chief G10 FX Strategist Audrey Child Freeman. Audrey, give us your call here, euro-dollar.
I'm afraid the risk continues to be tilted to the downside for the euro. A few weeks ago, this move lower was mainly driven by positive headlines out of the U.S. and mainly a bullish dollar move. And this, in the past week or so, we've had negative headlines coming out of Europe, which are exacerbating the downside for the euro, in particular on the COVID headline front with more lockdowns. And that has obvious implication for the outlook for the eurozone economy. And that really gives you very little incentive to get back exposure into euro for the time being.
So to that point, I've seen a lot of strategists start to talk about 110, et cetera. What kind of scenario would we have to be looking at to see 110 or below?
Well, so we're getting into year-end now, so the flows are going to be a lot lighter, and that's always a recipe for sharp moves in the FX market. That, you know, tends to happen. And we're already trading near 112.50. So 110 is really not that far away anymore. So, you know, what I feel has been quite interesting in the past week in particular is how much the euro has reacted to the headlines on COVID, in particular anything coming out of Germany.
Audrey, where's the ECB in this discussion? Because here in the States, obviously, we have tapering taking place here by the U.S. Federal Reserve. Talk about rate hikes potentially as soon as mid next year. What's the environment from a banking perspective in the EU?
Well, the ECB is obviously going to lag most central banks in its policy normalization and its rate normalization process in particular. And I think, you know, from a growth perspective, the COVID headlines we're getting out of Europe now really are no game changer for the outlook for the economy next year. It will bring a downside bias into the numbers that we'll get out of Europe for December. But the growth dynamics for Europe are quite supportive for next year. And the support for the eurozone growth partly comes from the fact that I feel the ECB will keep and maintain a very accommodative monetary policy environment. for as long as possible, and certainly I feel for much longer than what we're going to see in the U.S. And that's a crucial element for, you know, continuing to exploit more downside on the euro versus the dollar. So as long as we're driven by rate differential and expected rate differential, the U.S. dollar wins, and mm-hmm. this is not going to change anytime soon.
Well, that's such a great point, and I wondered what you made of the recent downturn in the euro. Is that more dollar-driven or Europe-driven? Because it feels like there's been a shift just in the last week or so when we're dealing with sort of regional lockdowns and new restrictions over in Europe, where it's become more of a euro-negative story rather than a dollar-positive story. But what's your take?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what we've had. We've had, for the past 7 or 8 weeks, it was very much U.S.-driven, and the Fed tapering talk, and you may remember the very strong inflation reading that we had out of the U.S., that was a trigger for another leg higher, and not just against the euro, by the way. The restrictions were announced in some European countries. We suddenly shift onto Europe and more negative headlines into Europe. So, you know, as I said, I think for now it's obviously negative for the eurozone, but I don't think it kind of changes dramatically the outlook for the eurozone growth prospect for next year. It just means that any hypothetical recovery in the euro dollar and in the euro in general will happen later than expected, and most likely from a lower base than expected, because we're getting this hit now. And that could continue in the next few weeks, because the next thing that will happen is that after the restrictions come into play, you're going to start to see some of the eurozone numbers starting to underwhelm. And at the same time, you see the U.S. data continuing to outperform. So that would translate into higher yield differential. And if you're euro-dollar downside, that's the trade that works. And it's difficult to contemplate what could change that for getting into year-end and as we contemplate the outlook for early next year.
I'm wondering if we can get a little technical here, kind of coming into the year with a 1.24 on the euro dollar. Boy, now we're down to 1.12. Are traders that you talk to, are portfolio managers that you talk to, are they calling out any technical support coming up?
Well, it's very interesting because we had a target on the downside at 1.15, and it went through quite easily. And now it's the 1.10 level that no one talked about for such a long time, and yet it seems so close to us. So this is the obvious level that we're all going to be talking about. I think that once we get towards that level and lower, maybe you sit and think, is that too much? Is that time to get back into the euro? I'm not convinced just yet.
So if we take a look at the last month and we look at currencies, it's WCRS is the function on your terminal, and you do the base as euro. The euro has underperformed the most to the U.S. dollar, but it's also underperformed the yen, the franc, the Canadian dollar, the British pound, New Zealand dollar. And I wonder if there's another currency cross where the euro has a little bit more juice to the downside than the dollar.
That's a very interesting point. And as, you know, investors start to think about the outlook for 2022, and if you don't want to have all of your exposure on euro dollar, or just being long dollar, there's another currency that I really like, and that's the Canadian dollar. So the Canadian dollar is an excellent proxy for the U.S. dollar. Mm. And if you believe that the U.S. dollar has still another leg higher, which I kind of think it will, I think you kind of diversify. You put some euro dollar downside, Canadian dollar, euro CAD downside. And you could also think about some European currencies that trade as a proxy to the euro, and implement those views against the Canadian dollar or the U.S. dollar. In particular, I'm thinking about sterling. So cable downside is another one that I would still hold on into year-end and early next year, as well as sterling CAD right. downside. So these are quite interesting crosses and different ways to implement the same theme and the same views without just being stuck with euro dollar.
All right, Audrey, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate getting your thoughts here on the currency business. Audrey Child-Freeman, Bloomberg Intelligence, Chief T10 FX Strategist.
Well, coming up on the show, brick and mortar revival. Retailers could get a boost from an in-store shopping this holiday season, something I never thought I'd say.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BIGO on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney.
And I'm Alex Steele. It is 25 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
We'll be here each and every week at this time, tapping into our Bloomberg Intelligence analysts covering some 2,000 companies and 130 industries worldwide.
So I guess we're going to party like it's the 1980s. That
the
could
80s
be. The 80s were fun.
A very good decade for me, I'll tell you that.
They
right
were?
Now. Yes.
Were they good? You didn't have white hair then?
No, I did not.
I had a really great leopard dress that was pink and green and blue with spots.
Oh, that's
it was amazing.
Very
my
cool.
Hairstyle was out of this world. Anyway, apparently for this holiday season, we could be shopping like it's the 80s. That dress would most definitely be back in style. I want to bring in Bloomberg Intelligence retail analyst Y No. The thesis behind this, Y, is that the brick and mortar stores are going to crush it this holiday season. That feels kind of similar to what we saw for retail earnings. What's your thesis right now?
That's correct, Alec. You're basically seeing a reversal of last year's trend that there was more online sales, but this year we're seeing more consumers returning to brick and mortar. We've been doing channel checks and the malls are already starting to get busy. Over 50% of consumers have already said that they started the Christmas shopping in October and into before the Black Friday specials. But consumers are just looking for more experience-driven shopping back to the old days. And so that's why it kind of resembles the 80s.
But I mean, the reality is the pandemic and changed consumer behavior, and now everybody is an expert on e-commerce and what buttons to click to get what, and there's boxes arriving in front of the door every single day. That trend is not going to reverse itself, is it?
We're still going to have online commerce, but it's not going to be as high as the record levels we saw last year. You have to remember that a lot of retailers are omnichannel focused. So if you look at Macy's, they say the average customer who shops omnichannel shops 2.5 times to 3.5 times more than the single channel customer. So a lot of the retailers are also implementing buy online, pick up in store, because a lot of the retailers want you to go into the store because, you know, you shop and you walk around, you get ideas, you pick up more things, and it kind of increases your basket size.
Yeah, guilty of that for sure. What kind of stores are doing that the best? So I tend to do that a lot with Target, for example. Are there certain categories or certain stores that the omnichannel is going to keep crushing it for them?
Well, Target, for example, is a very good example. So if you were to do a buy online pickup, some of the Black Friday promotional sales at Target, you're seeing that in order to get the discount, you have to go into the store, right? And Macy's is certainly doing that. Kohl's is certainly trying to lure shoppers into the store. And, you know, a lot of the promotional stuff requires some level of store activity in order to get that discount.
All right, so let's talk about promotions, because when I talk to retail analysts, they always tell me it's not just about same store sales and driving revenue. It's also about the promotions, because that goes right to the margin line. Is there going to be a lot of promotions this holiday season?
I think there will be fewer promotions this holiday season. It's a combination of things. There's supply chain issues that most consumers think that, you know, things are going to run out of stock. So the retailer really doesn't have as much of incentive to discount the merchandise. And then second, everyone is well aware of inflation. And we actually did a Bloomberg survey and over 50% of respondents believe that prices would be higher this season. And what that equates to for retailers is higher merchandise margins, because you can offset that higher shipping cost by being less promotional this season.
So what I've noticed personally, because I live for holiday shopping deals, is that a lot of the deals are like free shipping. Like that's the deal because it's so expensive to ship. Or it's like, we're going to give you 10% off. Here's $5 off that towel that you wanted, which is like nothing. That's not the kind of deals that we're used to. What are people buying right now?
Well, according to our Bloomberg survey, the things that people are buying for this holiday season, electronics always higher. Toys is also a high category. Clothing is higher. What people are in the clothing category, the categories that are doing really well are athleisure wear. As we quite frank, Americans gained a little bit of weight this season, so people want that more comfortable active
Whoa,
wear.
Outing us, whatever. Fair enough.
I am guilty as well, but definitely if you look at the category of jeans, like skinny jeans, 2 years ago, Gap would say that skinny jeans was about 90% of their inventory. Today, they're saying about skinny jeans is probably about 50% of their inventory. Mm-hmm. So you're definitely seeing a size shift, and the retailers are offering a lot more, promoting a lot more size inclusivity. So if you look at Gap, they have a Bodhi quality campaign going on right now. And a lot of the stores are offering more plus size to accommodate the average American.
All right. If I do go into a store, and it's a big, big if, is there going to be any stuff on the shelves?
There will be. The major department stores such as Macy's are saying that they have built enough inventory to meet the demand. But there will be some categories that will sell out, such as certain electronics, that there may be empty shelves. And that is kind of the impetus behind the less promotional environment as well.
You can't, like, replace the Barbie Dreamhouse 2021
that your
daughter asked for from Santa with anything but the Barbie Dreamhouse 2021.
There's no substitution effect for that?
There's models for each year, but she's going to know if it's not the 2021.
Sure,
so you're kind of, like, locked into a corner. Hey, Y, this was really great to talk to you. Thank you so much. Love the somewhat counterintuitive point of view from what I think both Paul and I were expecting. Y Ngo joining us there from Bloomberg Intelligence. He's a retail analyst.
Coming up on the program, driving decarbonization. Asset managers are set to become the new enforcers of carbon change. Plus, the outlook for the food and beverage sector amid cost pressures.
You are listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 39 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
COP26 was historic for many reasons. It did mention coal in the communique. There were a lot of participants of different governments there, but it left a lot of questions as to how the agreement is actually going to be implemented and who's in charge. Is it governments? Is it investors? Is it companies? Well, let's break it down a little bit right now with Bloomberg Intelligence senior EU insurance analyst Charles Graham. Charles, you have a piece out for Bloomberg Intelligence that says that asset managers are going to become the enforcer for carbon change. What's the thesis?
I think one of the encouraging things to come out of COP26 was the willingness of asset owners and asset managers to take a much more active role in effectively enforcing and policing the transition to a net zero carbon environment. And we've seen over the last few years the development of a UN-convened group, which now numbers 61 major institutional investors, managing something like $10 trillion worth of funds, who have committed to a net zero 2050 target for their investment portfolios. And I think perhaps also more important than that, they've also committed to significant reduction in the carbon footprint of those portfolios by 2025, looking for reductions in the region of about 25%, and for rolling targets from then on through to 2050. So this is a big change in engaging with companies and encouraging them to adopt transitional measures in order to get to a more carbon neutral environment, and one where we can hopefully bring the 1.5% Paris temperature target back into focus.
Charles, do you think this push will be a global push on the part of asset managers, fund managers? Because it feels like it has a European, there might be a greater emphasis on it from European investors. Are you sensing it could be or will be a global story?
I think it's beginning to gather momentum. To be fair, I think perhaps driven by the historic political climate, American companies and American asset management businesses have been slower to come to the party. And it certainly has been the likes of Allianz in Europe and so on that have been driving this forward, along with some of the reinsurance companies. But I think there is evidence. I mean, we had, for example, within the group for this UN group, we have the California Public Employees Retirement System, for example.
That's big.
And we've seen others. I mean, BlackRock has made a commitment to net zero by 2050. They're not yet part of this group, and we haven't seen the stages that they want to go through to get to that position. But I think they're on board with the principle. I think maybe because of the different structure of their investment funds, they have more challenges in being able to monitor and reach those targets.
Well, that's what I was going to say. How do they execute this? Which is basically the problem for any government, you know, company or investment thesis. How do they execute?
Well, I think the really critical thing is disclosure. And here I think the role of the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures has played a really very important role. And that also needs to still gather further momentum. But it is moving us to a position in which more and more asset managers can analyze the assets that they're investing in through their listed equity portfolios or their corporate bond portfolios and begin to understand where the areas are, where they have a substantial carbon footprint. And those footprints tend to be quite highly skewed. So it's then a case of working with those companies and with those industries to understand what policies they're prepared to put in place in order to make this transition that the world needs to go through.
Thanks so much. It's an important conversation. Charles Graham, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior EU Insurance Analyst.
All right, let's talk inflation. I just filled up my gas tank of the car, and I was shocked at how much that cost. But then they say, hey, when you go shopping, that's where it's really going to hit your pocketbook. We've heard a lot of companies talking about passing along their cost increases to consumers. Let's get a sense of what's going on out there with Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Credit Analyst Mary Ross Gilbert. So, Mary, give us a sense here in terms of just consumer goods, food products. Talk to us about inflation. How much are these companies passing along and how much are they maybe taking in their margin?
Those are very good questions. So I think initially they are taking a hit on margin while they are passing on higher costs to the consumer. So if you look at the CPI data that came out recently where we saw the CPI up 6.2% in October, if you look at the food and beverage component, that was over 5%. That's how much they saw in the grocery store. But then there's other products in the store, meat, eggs, fish, those are up about 12%. So you can see that the consumer, as you pointed out, not only are you getting hit, you know, at the gas pump, but you're also getting hit in the grocery store. So while the food and beverage companies are passing on higher prices, there's a lag in which they're able to fully offset the cost pressures that they're experiencing. And so, I thought that Keurig Dr. Pepper CEO summed it up best when he said, let's be clear, the inflation the industry is seeing is way beyond commodities. It's products, it's packaging, it's labor, it's transportation. Mm-hmm. So you've been hearing a lot about that in terms of supply chain snarls.
Yeah. So in terms of the pass-through increases, even if we haven't seen the full effect, are consumers changing their behavior because of it?
That's another very good question. It's something we've been following closely, and we just saw signs that we may start to see a shift in consumer behavior. So what's been happening since COVID is we've seen very strong demand for branded goods. And as some of these price increases have been going through, that demand hasn't shifted if you look at the IRI data. But Post Holdings, which is known for their Pebble cereal, just reported last week and noted on their call that they're starting to see signs that you're going to see a shift toward private label. And Treehouse Foods, which is a leader in the private label side, they actually cited that they're seeing increased demand. So while we haven't seen it show up in the IRI data, we think it's coming. And the branded food companies want to be prepared, so they're focusing on innovation to try to minimize that impact.
So are the food and beverage companies that you talk to, Mary, are they saying that these inflationary pressures are, to use a term, transitory or something they need to plan for maybe some period of time?
Yeah, I would say that some of them might be transitory. That's certainly how we're viewing it. So, for example, let's take meat, right? Because meat has increased significantly this year, and ConAgra, which has a big exposure to both red meat and pork, has really been impacted. So pork prices have fallen 50% from its peak in early August. So it's almost down to where it started at the beginning of the year. Then if you look at palm oil and soybean oil, which is used in snacks, that's already fallen 3% and 17% respectively. Then if you get to packaging, aluminum prices, Okay, you're familiar with that being in autos and airplanes, but it's also in Campbell's soup cans.
Mm-hmm.
That's up 35% since the year started, but it has fallen 16% since its peak in October. Now, the one thing we're still seeing is elevated transportation costs, except the cost to ship containers. Even though it was up over 200% at its high, it's already fallen 20% over the last few months. And we think it's going to continue to fall in 2022.
So if that's the case, I'm wondering how sustainable overall the price increases are going to be. So if there is some light at the end of the tunnel for some of these products, once a company passes through a price increase, how sticky and committed do they feel to that? Or are we going to go back to the kind of deflationary price wars that grocers have been in for so long?
Right. Well, I think it's going to depend. So ConAgra said when I spoke to them that what they expect to happen is there's going to be a lag effect on the way down. They don't have to pass, they're not in a position where they have to pass through immediately. But we don't expect to see this ease to the consumer probably until the second half of 2022. So, because we're going to be still impacted in the first half of 22 for many companies. It's really going to depend. Some are more impacted than others. And so ConAgra thinks that they'll actually see a benefit.
Are you concerned about the cash flow ability of some of these companies as they deal with these inflation issues? Is that a risk for the credits?
We're not seeing that kind of risk. If you look at high yield, for example, probably one of the harder hit companies being Treehouse Foods, it's a lower margin business to begin with, and their debt leverage has climbed above 5 times. So, and I think it's going to climb a bit higher now when we get into the first half because their EBITDA is expected to be down about 20%. So that one, and it's been an underperformer. Stocks off 30%. The bond prices are down 10 points. So that kind of tells you, oh, wow, this company has been impacted adversely. But we do see signs that as they put forth multiple price increases, that in the second half of 22, they may be able to fully offset the negative impact in the first half completely and actually come out, you know, sort of even or slightly ahead for the full year in 22. So while it gets pretty tight, it's not to the point of, you know, seeing any kind of failure. Plus, I mean, there might be an opportunity for them to sell off some assets, and I think that's something they might be focused on.
Mary, really great analysis. We appreciate it. That's Mary Ross Gilbert, a Bloomberg Intelligence senior credit analyst.
That's this week's edition of Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
And remember, you can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 57 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.